Hello and welcome to A Little Less Conversation, the latest podcast series from Goodwill Hunters. I'm Goodwill Hunters founder, Rachel Mason-Nunn. It's great to be back. Earlier this year, as you may remember, we collaborated with ACFID, the Australian Council for International Development, on a series centred around the new development policy. That policy was out in August, and we received amazing listener numbers and feedback on the series, so thank you to everyone who tuned in. High up on the list of feedback from you, our listeners, was a clear interest in climate change. So we've listened, and we've returned to ACFID, as well as another organisation that Goodwill Hunters has partnered with in the past, WWF Australia. So this series is a three-way collaboration. Jess McKenzie from ACFID is back, along with Dermot O'Gorman, the head of WWF Australia. It's called A Little Less Conversation because what we all really want is to wind down the talk fest and scale up the climate action. Across these episodes, we're going to critically examine climate change in the international development context, particularly policy. Jess and Dermot, welcome back to you both.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks. It's so exciting to be back.
Hi, Rachel. Equally excited to be back. Excited about how the world is changing in a positive way on climate. So looking forward to getting into the conversations.
This is very timely.
Very timely. Yes, absolutely. And it's been a big year with the new development policy, which we all know had climate at the forefront, but it's a bit early to tell exactly how that's going to play out in practice, which is something we'll get into in this series. But the point of this episode is to bring everyone up to speed with where we're now at. So, Jess, earlier in the year, we got together for the Reimagining Development series, which was centred around the new development policy, as I just mentioned. Let's start by talking about climate change as a part of that policy. In your view, how big of a feature was it?
Oh my gosh, it was central, wasn't it? So I think the policy itself described climate as a foremost concern of our region and the single greatest threat to livelihoods, security and well-being of the Pacific peoples in particular. But it was really woven right through the policy, and that was really impressive to see. So there were probably four major new areas of emphasis: climate, gender equality, locally led and civil society as well. And for those who haven't read it, it's five scintillating chapters with 14 key commitments, but they didn't organize it around sectors. So what you noticed was that climate was really woven through the whole thing, from the approach to the focus to the systems that they're going to implement. And it was in there, I think it was, we counted 27 times because we're nerds. But what's interesting to me is there was this new target for new bilateral programs and regional programs, which will have to have anything over $3 million will have to have a climate objective from 2024-25, half of all new programs, and about 80% by 2029. So there's this real shift in what they're going to be counting, which is great. And then there was also a commitment to specifically analyze climate risk at the country level. So what we're seeing now is that policy being implemented in the new country strategies, so the development partnership plans, and climate is central in all of them so far. Dermot, you've done a series with Rachel, but this is the first time we're doing this together. What's your take on the state of climate change policy?
Yes, I think if I reflect, Jessica, on the conversations in the previous podcast, when I, this was more than sort of 3 years ago. There were three things that I heard in there. First of all, Australia has the opportunity to be a renewable energy superpower. Came out as a theme for that listening and those conversations. It also was climate change is an issue that touches all part of society. So you need to mainstream climate into all your policies. Yeah. And the third one was, come on, Australia, you are a laggard in the world on climate change. You have a chance to lead, time to step up, not step back. And so I think if I reflect on the current state of play, we're seeing a lot of things, and we'll maybe have a chat about them in detail, that follow those messages that the people in the podcast 3 and a bit years ago said to us we should be exploring. And you know, that development, international development policy, mainstreaming climate is a really nice example, Jess. You just talked about of DFAT just doing that, making climate a central part of its development policy.
Okay, Dermot, what are the major priority areas that WWF would say need to be there in the shift on thinking for climate change?
Look, I think building on those three themes that we heard about in the last podcast. The Prime Minister has said, the Treasurer has said that, you know, they want Australia to be a renewable energy superpower. To do that, we need to do that in a way that's nature positive and brings communities along that benefit in that transition to renewables. And so I think making sure that we have a just, fair and best transition to be a superpower, both domestically but also internationally. And I think the second part of what WBF is really focused on is really around the world, and particularly in Asia Pacific, how can you use tools like nature-based solutions to build resilience for communities? And there, I think ACFID members have played a really key role in our region in modeling and supporting some of that work supported by DFAP. And the last area is, a decade ago, a climate COP was a small group of government officials who disappeared into a meeting room for a couple of weeks and came out with a declaration. Today, they are probably the biggest trade fair on the planet for renewables. And it now is central to a whole lot of economic policy and security policy and diplomacy work. And so the potential for Australia and the Pacific to host COP31 in 2026 is potentially a game changer. But how might we do that differently? And having just come back from the Cook Islands Pacific Island Forum, how do we put First Nations and Pacific Island voices front and center of a global COP?
Yes, let's hope we don't break the game. Rachel, this is your podcast and you've done a number of series over the years. Can I just ask you, given your perspective across the whole batch, why do you think this matters now? Why now for climate, and what are some of the episodes we're going to cover?
It's a really important question. And I think if we step back for a moment and take a look at where we are globally right now. So we've just come out of a pandemic, which completely reshaped the world as we know it. And it's not over. I mean, we continue to have waves of COVID, but the economic and social and health impacts of the pandemic live on. We had a subsequent cost of living crisis, which has driven up unemployment and had a flow-on effect to many development indicators and has caused a regression in many hard-won development gains. And we also have a climate which continues to change. And in many ways, the people on the front line of that are people in our region, and especially in Asia and the Pacific, as we know. And so we've got all of these intersecting vulnerabilities, which can no longer be addressed as silos. And in many, you know, for a number of reasons, development is harder and more complex than ever now, right?
Completely agree.
And climate is a huge part of that. And I think we have been able to have a development sector and have climate priorities and keep them quite separate for the last decade. And we can no longer do that. In the same way, we realized 10 years ago that being gender blind in our aid program just wasn't working, because women were experiencing poverty and inequality in a very different and significant way to others. And we realize now that people on the front lines of a changing climate are experiencing vulnerabilities in a way that others aren't to the same extent. And if our development program isn't addressing that, then what's it really doing? And so I think we've had this watershed moment, but now I think we're exploring, okay, so what does this mean in practice? And as I said at the start, we have a development policy now which is really cognizant of the climate, and how many mentions were there, Jess? 27 or something?
27.
And it permeates the policy. It's in our climate finance approach. It's there in a big way, but how do we operationalize that? And what does that look like? And how does it intersect with Australia's broader goals as the kind of partner we want to be to the region and the kind of role we want to have in the fight against climate change? So we're at a really interesting juncture, and that's what we'll be exploring in this series, is many different angles to look at that from sort of the policy perspective through to nature-based solutions, through to the significance of international fora on climate like COP, And ironically, we've called the series A Little Less Conversation, but it is a series of conversations. However, what we're getting at is the fact that the time for conversation is passing, and the time for practical evidence-based action rather than continued commitments and rhetoric and other things is now.
Completely agree. It's taken from that Elvis Presley song, of course, A Little Less Conversation, but we'd change it to A Little More Climate Action, I think, if we could. There's so much ambition that was wrapped up in the new government, or not really new anymore, but the current government's ambition around climate change and also in the new international development policy. And there's this wording that says Australia's going to do more to help partners and we're going to accelerate global ambition. And I guess what we have now is this opportunity to see that translate into programs and funding. And that's why I'm really excited about doing this now and looking at things like loss and damage funds that are being shaped as we speak, looking at the mitigation and adaptation programs that are underway. And a line I often hear is, we're in the market for ideas when I go to meetings. And I just feel like there's so many ideas across this group that if we're translating that ambition into funding and programs, there's a lot of people who have some great answers that they can offer up.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think something that's struck me in recent years, especially working in the Pacific, is the opportunity created by emerging industries and kind of this renegotiation of what capitalism means and supply chains and the economy. And there's sort of been this forced ingenuity and entrepreneurship in the region to not just adapt, but kind of evolve. And there's this really interesting and fresh take, I think, on what opportunities lay ahead for us if we can embrace this opportunity to transition head on and work collaboratively to do so. And so I think something I'm looking forward to in this series is hearing those ideas and opportunities and this being framed in a way which does present this as this fantastic opportunity to seize upon if we choose to. And I think, Dermot, in the series that we did together, as you said, it was focused on the opportunity Australia has to be a renewable energy superpower, which is something that WWF has been very focused on alongside your Regenerate Australia campaign, which came post-bushfires. So as a business, WWF has done a really tremendous job at presenting the opportunities that lay ahead for us if we seize upon them. And I think that's something I'm really keen for us to highlight in this series.
Yeah, look, Rachel, that solution message I'm hoping is going to come out in this conversation that we're having with some very extraordinary people who are doing some amazing work in this space. You mentioned the Pacific, and I think that what we've seen the Pacific leaders do in the last 5 to 8 years is really step up on the global stage as global climate leaders in their own right. You know, the pivot from Pacific small island states to big ocean states to the blue Pacific continent is part of them reframing the whole climate discussion and driving a big global agenda. And you're seeing some great Pacific leaders out there into various global forum really changing global policy. And that's exactly what we want to see. So I think being able to learn from our Pacific colleagues and support that in terms of changing global climate policy, I think is a really exciting thing. I'm keen to hear from a variety of our sort of podcasters over this next series.
I agree. The Pacific's been at the forefront of a lot of the climate change work. And I feel like it's not just about hearing their voice. I feel like they have so much of the knowledge of what works that the world actually needs to hear from them. And they're frankly not heard enough. And we know that there's that big intersection with the International Development Program, $1.9 billion is being spent annually, I think, which is a historic high. Like that's just so much money. And the proportion of that's climate is quite large now too.
Yeah, I think something that raises for me, which I'm keen to get both of your views on, and which I suspect listeners will be thinking about as this series goes on, is if we think about the big picture of what needs to be spent on climate adaptation, mitigation, loss and damage, we're talking about a pretty huge amount, right? Like this is not a small magnitude of change and reform that needs to happen. And if we cross-reference that with the size of, you know, traditional aid flows like ODA, it's a very small percentage of the total amount that needs to be spent in this space. And I think for me, that raises two questions. I think one is in the development sector. I think we tend to think our money can go a lot further than it can, when the reality is, like, this kind of works hard and it's expensive. And, you know, we have to be realistic in what we can actually do with the finite amount of money we have. So one question is, how do we prioritize where traditional aid flows focus in the climate space? And then two is, outside of traditional aid flows, what's the role of the development sector in being a catalyst in kind of the broader climate change agenda? Like, how are we advocating and positioning and campaigning as a development sector for this much larger climate change program of reforms and measures that need to take place? I'd be keen to get both of your views on that.
And I think talking to Henry Gonzalez from the Green Climate Fund will be really interesting about how the money that is being committed, I think they're the largest fund in the world on climate, looking at how that is being spent well, whether it's fast enough, whether it's accessible enough, and how they're leveraging private sector funds and philanthropics. And I think that should be a common theme throughout the whole series. Because as you said, Rachel, we're sort of entering this point where it's becoming a bit transformational, but the structures are still being built. Like, how do you do impact investing around climate, for example? We're still formulating those ideas of whether development practitioners are at the helm for the design work. For example, there's this intersection, and it's sort of a bit of a power struggle between people who have traditionally been in the school of climate change learning and practice, often domestically, and then people who have spent a long time, equally long time as the climate change practitioners, on international development programs, mainstreaming gender, doing M&E frameworks, and the two schools are now meeting squarely in the center.
Rachel, I think your question goes to the heart of the sort of climate challenge, both in terms of mitigation and the transition to renewables, but also then how do we build out resilience so that communities that are on the front line are able to manage some of the impacts that climate change is giving to them at the moment, and unfortunately is going to get worse. And so I'm excited to hear from Ambassador Tilley, because I think we're going to hear a little bit about the role that Australia sees themselves playing in this transition. Certainly from my view, if we have a look, you know, getting off fossil fuel dependencies in the Pacific. So, you know, a fossil fuel Pacific is a call from the Pacific. There's a lot of logic that Australia can use expertise and technology and resources to help do that. And then we're going to hear about practical solutions like nature-based solutions about how we can help communities build up. The flip side of that is that when we talk to David Pocock, he's going to talk about a lot about Australia's domestic climate change and energy policy and, you know, how Australia can be a renewable energy superpower. One of the big changes I've seen is the international development sector get much more involved in domestic agenda reform, because their Pacific partners, for example, says you cannot not have a position on Australian gas and coal. It's untenable. You need to be able to say something domestically as well as advocating for Pacific issues as well. And I think that is going to play out in the conversations that we're going to have. So I think I'm interested to hear what people say.
I'm really looking forward to having Senator Pocock on as well to get into that domestic piece. And I think you're right that the Pacific are only going to get more and more vocal in their calls for Australia to be accountable and to take a position. I think to your earlier point, Dermot, around how, as a development program, do we look at things like climate resilience? How do we look at mitigation and adaptation? After 5 years of doing this podcast, there's a couple of quotes that are like etched into my brain. And one of them was when I've had Jackie DeLacy on a few times, and I love talking to Jackie. And we had a conversation a few years ago where we talked about the huge scale of ambition in PNG, how Australia is basically, you know, in a multitude of sectors in PNG, trying to be a catalyst for huge reform across health, education, governance, leadership, gender. And we ask ourselves, are we helping to push the dial? And Jackie reminded me that the value of our entire aid program in PNG is the same amount of money that Canberra spent upgrading their buses. And it's one of those things that has always stayed in my mind, is there's this huge ambition and then there's this price that just doesn't match the scale of the ambition at all. And I guess my fear with the new development policy talking about climate being mainstreamed into all of the programs is that's fine. And it's fine. In the same way, it's been fine for us to add gender indicators, and it has really centered gender in all of our programs. But is that ambition going to be matched by an appropriate level of resourcing? And I think the answer in ODA terms is no. But I think that requires us to think, how then are we investing in a strategic way which seeds ideas so that others can then pick them up and scale them? And I think for, you know, climate resilience is an interesting example of that. I also think it's clear Australia wants to support MSMEs in Southeast Asia in the renewable energy market. And in doing that, how can we then help them to attract additional funding? So this is one of the things I've been grappling with a lot since the policy came out, is in what areas do we invest strategically so that our investment is a catalyst for scale and further support down the track. Does this keep you up at night, or is this just me?
No, it keeps me up at night. Asking for the appropriate levels of ODA. I thought you didn't do repeat guests, Rachel. I guess Jackie DeLacy is the perfect person if ever someone was worthy of repeat guesting.
Jackie's who I make an exception for.
I think I heard something similar about the Canberra Hospital as well. So it gives you a sense of perspective to the amount of funding that's being contributed. I think that was for a whole health program in a particular bilateral country. I think about the ODA funds, and I think this government has been really forthcoming in their recent ALP platform about trying to grow to 0.36% ODA GNI, which is great. But what we're seeing internationally is a lot of donors are scaling back. So you can see the Swedes and the Brits are both reducing the overall percentage of their aid program within their national budgets, which I think is really disappointing just when you see this global need skyrocketing. What I keep coming back to is, all right, well, domestically, what's the architecture we're working with? How do we, if we're going to have to spend what we have better while asking for more to be spent, how do we make sure that it's being spent in a really strategic, really thoughtful way where people aren't rushed off their feet making reactive decisions, but they have space for long-term thinking? So one of the episodes I'm going to be looking forward to the most is the architecture of climate-focused government with Howard Bamsey. So I think in that we've got this new department, right? DQ, which stands for Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water. And that was established in, I think it was July 2022, right off the back of the new government. And that's meant to deliver on the government's climate change agenda. So traditionally you have these departments that might be domestic facing, whereas you'd have Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade that manages the development program, which would be international facing, but the line's not so clearly drawn between those two. And then you've got organizations like ACR and Emergency Management Australia doing great work. And, you know, defense has got all this great forecasting capability on climate as well as a risk that we're facing. So how do you bring all that together when you have negotiators going from DQ to these conversations on loss and damage or COPs, and then they're sort of leading on the policy and DFAT's doing the programs? How is that all going to play out so that we use what we have to the best of our ability when everyone is already stretched for time? Like, these teams are so busy and they're just trying to deliver what they were supposed to be delivering last year, much less with everything we're putting on top of them.
I think, Rachel, it's a question that I should ask the Green Climate Fund. What's their experience in leveraging the billions of dollars that they have to get climate financing and capital to really scale? The other bit that I think is a mental reset for the Australian government and for Australian industry is that if we're able to be a renewable energy superpower, as always, with every superpower comes responsibility. And I think one of those responsibilities is us to be increasing our ODA to support other countries in our region and around the world to both manage this transition in a fair and just and best way, but also to build that climate resilience that we were talking about. So I think we'd be keen to hear from Ambassador Tilley about that, maybe David Pocock. I think lots of them will have thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, Gemma, I'm really excited about those episodes too. I'm also really excited to cover the intersection of climate with gender, youth, and elders. And I think it's something we haven't seen done very much. I mean, I think the intersection of climate and gender is an interesting one and is an emerging field of research. And I've read a few different takes on this. I know that our current ambassador for gender equality, Stephanie Cobus Campbell, is really interested in the intersection of gender and climate, among others. You know, I think this is an area of emerging interest across the aid program, shall we say. And so I'm really keen to have Carolyn Kitione on the show, who is with the Shifting the Power Coalition based in Fiji and is a youth activist who also works across gender, to start to understand how climate change is specifically translating for not just for women, but also for young people who we know have been incredibly vocal on this issue, both in Australia and in the Pacific and in other parts of the world, and also elders, which is a group that I think is really important for the Pacific, especially that we cover in this discussion.
What I'm looking at too, Rachel, is you've got this increased interest globally in the Pacific that I'm noticing. So the EU is scaling up their work on climate in the Pacific. USAID is leaning in much more in the Pacific. The FCDO, the Brits, are putting out their new international development white paper in November, which will have a huge focus on climate. And so we already know how hard donor coordination is. We already know that most of these departments in our partner countries are strapped with donor coordination units, where it's pulling people into meetings where they're not actually doing the delivery they need to. So I'm really interested how we make sure this is all coordinated in the field with that increased interest.
So I think at COP28, we're going to see youth voices really standing up, not only to say, you know, we need to be investing in loss and damage and building community resilience to the impacts of climate change, but I think particularly in terms of exiting from fossil fuels. You know, we've seen the Port Vila Declaration. That's where I think we're going to see youth voices really loud and noisy in COP28.
I hope so. I think that's something to look forward to in COP28, and it'll be great to have Carolyn on the show to explore some of those youth voices. I know for me, in an Australian context, I find things like the school strike for climate so inspiring, and to see this generation and their commitment to doing something and their advocacy, it's really exciting. And I think in recent years, we've seen that more and more in an Australian context, but I think it's great to be able to shine more of a light on that in the Pacific as well. I'm curious to know from both of you, what are you most hoping to learn personally from this series? Like at the end of the series, what do you hope to be able to take away and apply in your work? Because all three of us actually do work in the development sector and work sort of at the intersection of climate and development every day. And so I think on a personal level, I know that I'm going to learn a lot that I can apply to my work in this series. So I'm curious to know from both of you what you're hoping to take away.
I'm sure I'm going to learn a huge amount. I already learn a lot from our members on a regular basis who are working in this area. I'm going to learn two things, I hope, Rach. The first is probably a bit nerdy, but I'm always interested in how you measure things. And I'm really interested because we have this milestone moment coming up at COP28 in UAE, where we're meant to be seeing the world take stock of progress against the Paris Agreement. So for me, this feels really well timed, and I'm going to be keeping an ear out for how we measure progress against that and the gaps that we haven't been able to cover. And for me, that's really answering where maybe Australia, with this new ambition and catalytic approach, can try to help generate a bit of change, particularly in the Pacific, whose voice doesn't often get heard, which I think would be wonderful. So I want to get that macro level of where's the progress not been forthcoming. And on another angle, which is quite different actually, we're talking to a lot of these really important personalities who are going to be shaping the landscape for climate for the next 10 years. And I want to understand what makes them tick and what drives them, because they all bring something different to why they're doing this work. Some of them might have really strong domestic experience that they're sort of, you know, bringing to the table, or they might have networks, or I think understanding why they're doing this would be really helpful for me, because these are going to be the players who shape the next 10 years in many ways.
Rachel, I think my thoughts are really on this, are really shaped by the 2019-2020 bushfires that hit Australia. That catastrophe, I think, brought home to me, and I think pretty much all 25 million Australians and most of the world, that climate change is impacting now. It is having devastating impacts to communities all over the world, particularly those on the front line. And so there's a degree of trauma that people are experiencing about, you know, how do we deal with this crisis? We've had more bushfires in the last years. We've had floods all over the world. But I think so the insights that I'm looking forward to hearing from our guests is solutions and pathways and messages of hope that we can step up and solve this problem. And so I think we're gonna hear a lot about work that's going on in the climate space at all different levels: government, the UN and intergovernment agencies, state governments, communities, First Nation communities. I'm hoping that I'm going to take away messages of hope that we can, if we really double down on this, there's still time to make a difference. And I think that's, for me, what I'm hoping, those messages of hope are the bit that I'm looking to listen and learn from this podcast series.
Yeah, great ones. I think my two cents quickly: one, I'm always keen to talk about gender, young people and elders, always really keen to understand the specific needs of different groups and how we can be more aware of them. That's one. The second one is civil society and the role of civil society in all of this and how best we can support them. I think a really interesting part of the new policy, I'm probably going to get the name wrong here, but was the Civil Society Partnerships Fund. And we don't yet know what that's going to look like in practice, but it was interesting to see Australia make this explicit commitment to funding civil society and partnering with civil society in the region. And I was at the CID, New Zealand's Council for International Development conference, a couple of months back, talking specifically about civil society and how our development program can make sure that we are helping to advocate for them and amplify their voices and give them, you know, the resources that they need to do what they do best. And I'm sure that's something that will come up in the series, but I'm very keen to understand how practically we can be a better partner to civil society.
I love that all three of us are looking for different things and going to learn different things from the podcast. That doesn't surprise me at all. All right. Well, guys, we're out of time, so that's all for today. But stay tuned, as we'll be dropping episodes regularly before and during COP28. In our next episode, we'll be speaking with Australia's climate ambassador, Kristen Tilley. Here's a little teaser of what she'll be talking about.
The new development policy we were talking about before, that recognises many of those things that you just said: the importance of locally led development, engagement, consultation, listening. You will have heard many of our ministers refer constantly to listening. I can assure you, having observed it, that is what our ministers and, in fact, you know, under them, us officials do when we engage with Pacific Island countries in particular. And it's the rollout of the new development policy that I think over the next year or so, as these development partnership plans are released and finalised, that you'll see the fruits of what that looks like in practice.
Do tune in. It's a fascinating discussion about the current priorities of her portfolio. Thanks for listening. Bye for now. We've been Rachel Mason-Nunn, Dermot O'Gorman and Jess McKenzie on the A Little Less Conversation podcast. See you soon.